Outdoors coming on the airwaves, coming your way.
Hey now, we're outside indoors, beat on a buck on a snowy day.
Hey now, we're inside outdoors, baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Inside Outdoors is brought to you from the beautiful rolling hills, forests, and lakes of southern Indiana. Produced in Bloomington and brought to you live every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. Inside Outdoors features hosts Don Jordan, Buddy Bill Moser, and Rich Reardon, and gives you everything you need to know about the outdoors surrounding our local community, our state, and around our nation. With fishing, hunting, local and national outdoor news, the environment, natural resources, safety, issues in our community, and just down-home family fun, our goal is to inspire how to be a good steward of our precious natural resources. You can call into our show at 812-323-1200 and ask a question or tell us what's on your mind. So sit right back, get a cup of coffee, journey with us into the lakes and woods, and find out what our natural resources have to offer. If you miss the show, you can listen online at WFHB.org. Just go to the public affairs listing, and you'll find a podcast of our show at Inside Outdoors. This is WFHB Bloomington, Indiana, volunteer-powered community radio at 91.3 FM for South Central Indiana, also 98.1 in Bloomington, 100.7 in Brown County, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org.
Good morning, Bloomington. This is Inside Outdoors, and I'm Don Jordan. I'm here with my buddies, Rich and Alan.
Happy
morning, guys.
Happy Saturday. We're rolling right into February. I think it's going to be a warm February. It doesn't seem like it's cold, but it's not that cold yet.
Well, it's pretty darn cold.
Yeah. See, it's cold enough for me, and as long as we don't get any cold in like April, like we have been, it's a mild winter, and then we have a super cold spring and knocks all my apple blossoms off of the trees, and
yes.
I'll be happy.
usually gets the peaches too.
Yep. Oh yeah. I got an apricot tree that we might get apricots off of it about once every 5 years, and it just seems to be that when they get there's about 2 or 3 days I've got to get out there and get them before the raccoons strip the tree bare.
Huh. Yeah. Raccoons know when they're ripe.
Yes, they do.
The night before you meant to pick them.
The night before I do.
Right, that's right. They're very slick.
They test.
Yes, they are.
Well, let's see.
Well, I'll tell you what. The lake level is 538.48, up just a hair from last week or 2 weeks ago, because we weren't here because WFHB had a little issue with their. Something that had to do with broadcast. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but anyway.
Something to do with that.
Yeah. You know. Something went down. I think it was on the tower, and they had to have it replaced. So it was only, we took a week off. Anyway, that's the bottom line. And Buddy Bill's not feeling too good, and I haven't really been able to contact him. So
I got a call from him, but my phone wasn't available at the time.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I've got a problem reaching him because my phone, all phones in Bloomington will not deal with his home phone or his cell phone. His cell phone goes right to message, and so does his, well, if I can get through, it either is like a busy signal or whatever. Nobody can figure it out. Course.
Now, didn't you tell me that your female companion has no trouble getting through?
No trouble whatsoever.
Neither do I. You know, how about you, Alan? Have you tried calling Bill?
I have not, but I will. Because I was a little concerned about him this morning. Didn't know how I was. I should reach out myself.
Yeah, let's see what's going on. Anyway, what was it? The temperature I was getting to. That's right.
Oh, yes. The temperature
is 45 degrees. So
I would say it's at least that.
Bill would say no skinny dipping for me right now. So
yes, that's what I.
Well, I walked, I drove across the causeway, and of course there was, this weekend there was a thin sheet of ice.
Yeah.
You know, on the slow side over there for quite a ways out on both sides. Usually it's usually on the slow side, but even on the quick side out there in front of Mellencamp's, there was a thin sheet of ice all the way over to the docks over there, the DNR docks. So it's the water's been cold.
Yeah.
Very cold.
Yeah, I think it's probably a little lower than that because they don't seem to update the temperature very quickly. So I'm kind of giving it a general thought for this time of year because of the way it's been a little bit warmer, but I tell you what, if you're seeing ice, then it's got to be colder than 47. It's probably down to about 35 or so.
You know, there's always been that, you know, differential, and there's a technical way to measure the water temperature. And I know that it's several feet down, you know, and it has to be anchored and away from flowing water and all that other stuff. So, you know, I suspect that these mornings when it's down into the 20s, that the upper few inches is probably well below freezing. And, you know, below that, of course, it's insulated a little bit, but, I certainly would like to know, you know, what the surface temperature is. I'm, you know, hopefully if we're not going to get down a couple of feet into the water to figure that out. But I would like to know that. I don't know why they don't measure that in addition to the temperature, the way the, you know, the oceanic and atmospheric people like to have it measured.
Well, I know that they measure it down there at the spillway. So I don't know whether that changes either when it gets so deep. You know, obviously that's about the deepest part of the lake.
And, you know, there's a lot of flow there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that probably affects the temperature as well. And I'm sure they need to know that because if it starts freezing around that blockhouse and some of the machinery down there, I assume that could cause some damage.
Right.
Which they probably aerate that to keep that from happening, but I'm sure they need to know that. But just, you know, from a livability standpoint, just from a visual standpoint, you know, the visual, you know, look of seeing ice out there, you know that it's less than 45 degrees.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, we were talking about this before the show, but you were reading up on something I thought was pretty interesting. Why don't we bring that up right away and talk about it a little?
Okay. Well, you know, I'm a huge fan of the outdoors and literature, and there's you know, obviously there's a lot of material out there. In fact, when I was an undergrad at Purdue, I even took a class in nature and literature. And there's some really great stuff out there that is pretty common. One of, you know, I give a lot of deference to real characters in writing, and I love Jim Harrison, not just his nonfiction and his fiction work that I think everybody's so familiar with, but he's got a book here called The Raw and the Uncooked: Adventures of a Roving Gourmand. And he talks about, as we all know, he was a gourmand. You know, he loved to eat, he loved to drink, and he went to a lot of trouble to, you know, stay at the very fringes of that activity. And he was very insightful about, you know, where that came from. Obviously food comes from nature. And he was talking in one of these little paragraphs. These are essays from about the early 90s. And one of them is a few pages long called Coming to Our Senses. And he's talking about how he doesn't eat, you know, store-raised porterhouses anymore, that he likes wild meat that came from cows that graze over a lot of area, and don't just eat alfalfa and gamma grass. Mm-hmm. They eat pods of, you know, all kinds of range trees from the West, and how that imparts flavor to it that we don't see anywhere else. And that leads to, of course, grazing on public land as well as private land. And his point, you know, gets to the sustainability of how that all works and the fight that ranchers and environmentalists and others who have who are stakeholders in natural public lands have. And, you know, his comments, you know, I'm just going to read a couple of sentences here that, you know, I think bear on still what we see. This was 30 years ago. There's been a lot of grotesque posturing on both sides of the fence regarding this issue of grazing of public lands. The bottom line is that the 263 million acres of public land used for private grazing does not deserve to be abused any more than it's permissible to deface the Lincoln Monument. If you do not believe land can lose its soul, look at land that has lost it. Right. And, you know, I love that. It's just a couple of sentences there, and it's tied to his preference for a different kind of beef. But I think that's, you know, we see, we don't have so much public grazing around here, but we do have public logging. And I think you want to talk about a piece of land that's lost its soul due to, you know, overlogging. Just look at the overlook over at Bean Blossom, that catastrophe that someone let happen over Brown County. Right. And I think we see that. And, you know, his words are always so eloquent. I'm just such a giant fan of Jim Harrison. But, you know, it's that was 30 years ago.
The Jim Harrison from, like, Legends of the Fall and that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I thought that's who you meant. But.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, he's such a character.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, we're not making Americans like that, I don't think. You know, Don is more familiar with that kind of writing than I am, because, you know, he does some of it. But you know, I'm always just amazed at not just the quality of the writing, but the insightfulness of it, and, you know, how it's still very timely to outdoorsmen today as it was 30 years ago.
Well, I agree. That's a good piece, Alan, along those lines. Have you heard about Senate Bill 389?
I think I did this week, yeah.
Okay, well, this is a law that wants to cancel out the Indiana wetlands protection laws.
Yeah.
And as you recall, you remember that Russian lady that ran for the state
yep.
Senate?
I do, well, indeed.
This is exactly what she had in mind when she yep. wanted to develop a subdivision out of a wetland that's on her property.
Yep.
And so this bill is in the Senate now, and it may have been introduced last Monday. And I just wanted to tell everybody that you, if you want to, you can contact your senators and representatives and let them know that how you feel about this. And there is actually a link to find your legislator. If you go to the iga.in.gov/legislative, and that ought to help you find your who to contact. And there's a form there. You have to put in your name and address, and then you can make a comment directly to whatever legislator comes up on your form.
Yeah.
And you know, we have lost 95% of our wetlands in Indiana, just like we've lost 90% of our tree cover or more than that. Yeah. I don't know exactly. But this is another assault on what's left.
Yeah.
And the Republicans are in the dominant position in both the House and the Senate, Indiana House and Indiana Senate. And it's going to be a long downhill slide for us if we don't manage to marshal some forces to stop these kinds of bills. So that's Senate Bill 389, in case you're interested.
Yeah, the wetlands have just vanished. Well, they didn't actually vanish. They've been destroyed. And it's they're probably is what I think you're right. There's probably less than 5% of the 5 or 10% of the original wetlands that we had in Indiana gone.
Oh, absolutely. Indiana Wildlife Federation is the outfit that's been trying to marshal some support for that, and you can find them at Indiana Wildlife Federation .org, and perhaps you can find a link there to find, you know, get, find more information and get this contact thing in hand. There, that's www.indianawildlife.org. One more time, www.indianawildlife.org. So,
Don, I assume that when they, the only thing that's keeping these wetlands is probably some sort of wildlife preservation sort of line in the sand. I assume that there's probably very little environmental impact studies, and that the only thing holding it back is the habitat for wildlife, which, you know, the Republicans in this state have had very little regard for a long time. So if that's the only thing stopping them, my guess is they really don't care about that.
Well, we know they don't care about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a given, but yeah, at least, you know, if you're going to die, you might as well go down fighting, you know?
Yep.
And, I saw some statistics on wetlands the other day, and nearly all animals go to these wetlands. They're islands of life in a sea of plowed land and subdivisions, pavement. And we need them. The worst thing, probably the worst wetland assault ever was took place in northern Indiana on the great Kankakee Marsh up there.
Yeah.
It was bigger than the Okefenokee. It was the largest wetland in the country, actually.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
It had a lake that covered hundreds of square miles that went stretched from south of Chicago clear down towards, you know, the other side of Kankakee, and was about, I suppose it was about 80 miles long and about 5 feet deep at average, and held thousands, millions actually, of waterfowl and other wildlife. And that's that was all gone, has been gone for 100 years.
Sure.
And what's left of that is overwhelmed with wildlife.
Yeah.
If you go up to that part of the state and you manage to find a wetland, you'll see every bird that you ever could have imagined you would see in Indiana, and more.
So anyway. I drove to Chicago for many years. Had an office up in Skokie, and I'd drive, and going up through Chicago, you know, up through Gary and there's still a little bit of those wetlands there. You can see them, but I mean, you could just imagine that going on for a long way, because the land isn't much different, you know, all the way through there. You can imagine all that being, you know, wetlands at one point.
Yes, and you can tell by the look of the soil. That's where all those big truck farms are. You want to see some black soil.
Yeah.
Man, that's it. You can grow big radishes, and that was all part of that swamp.
Sure.
That's all sediment that's in there, decomposed plants and other things. And, Cedar Lake. You know, you could drive right past Cedar Lake on one of those interstates, and that's one of the last remnants of that lake, the big Kankakee wetland.
Yep.
Big Kankakee Marsh. And, you know, the rest of the state, you see a little wetland here and there where some farmer has let a small woodlot live because he maybe had some reason or another. But the corporate farms don't care, and they want to get as much many bushels of corn out of that land as they can. So no fence rows, no wetlands, no woodlots, and goodbye wildlife.
You know, even farmers who had cattle ranches and got tired of eating their own beef and kept some woodland out there to have rabbit once in a while, to have game birds once in a while, they weren't stupid enough to take alternate sources of food off their own table.
Right. Well, that's possible. I know some farmers still think like that.
Yeah.
Some farmers set aside wildlife plots, since, I mean, the state and the federal government pays them, actually.
Yeah. Right.
You know, the Conservation Reserve Program.
Yep.
Well, you get close to those big cities, though, and the amount of money that some of the landowners, like the Russian lady from up north of Indianapolis there.
Yeah.
All they can see is the dollar signs that land represents if they could put a 300 house subdivision on it.
Yep.
And, you know, money talks. And
yep.
Especially when that party that used to be in charge at the White House is in charge.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and other thing about wetlands is the, you know, it's threatened species as well. It's not just species that you think of are losing their homes. There's 79, according to the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, that are threatened by the loss of these wetlands. And there's also, it's part of the life of cycle for fish, recreational fish too. A lot of them spawn and it's very important. As we know, in Lake Monroe, there's wetlands around it that are being targeted for logging and other things. So, and you know, it's not just species of wildlife, it's also absorbing stormwater and filtering groundwater and, you know, water purification things, flood management, all kinds of things that affect humans too, that we ought to be worried about as well.
Well, no water, no life. That's just a fact. And we don't act like it. Nestle's is pumping billions of gallons out of the ground in every state.
Yeah.
A giant French corporation, and yeah. We just hand them the keys to our water. You know, that can't go on forever.
No,
and you know, those businesses employ very few people. That's an automated system. They it's not like they're providing enough jobs to a community to ever make up for the damage they're doing.
Well, they sell it on the construction of the new bottling plant.
Right.
You know, you're going to provide some high paying jobs that last a little while.
Yeah.
And then it's over. And
yeah.
The water is going to be over too.
Yeah.
One of these days.
Well, and this policy is, you know, went straight from the White House, because in the last few years, the Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, and the Corps of Engineers have narrowed the types of waterways that are qualified for federal protection, which is what he was wiping out. So basically to try to improve the chances that corporations can make money without having to worry about the environment. And this affects half of the wetlands across the United States. So it's not just us that's in trouble. And but apparently the Biden administration is trying to reverse these orders, but it could be delayed because of, you know, federal rulemaking changes take a long time. You know what I mean? Besides what happens at the state.
These orders, at least when Trump signed them, they happened right away. And I don't see why they can't be acted on right away when Biden is retracting them. These are just, you don't have to have any congressional approval for these presidential executive orders.
Right.
You just write them.
They've got lawyers, Don. You know, those businesses have lawyers, whereas the other side really doesn't. When, you know, there's not a lot of lawyers on the side of the environmental people, but the people who are making money off of it do have lawyers, and all they got to do is bring a lawsuit to put a halt to all this. So, and they will.
We have lawyers. It's called the Department of Justice. And, now that we actually, I think, have a real Department of Justice again, and also all of these gigantic federal agencies, the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Forest Service, all of them have tons of lawyers.
Yeah.
So we don't have a shortage of lawyers if they do what they're supposed to do, if you get the right person telling them what to do, which we have now. So all hope is not lost. It just we need to be pushing all the time.
All the time.
That's right.
It'll be an endless job.
Well, it has been an endless job. I think I got really involved in it back in the Marble Hill days. Do you remember the Marble Hill nuclear plant?
Oh, yeah.
Down the Ohio River. I went down to a couple of those meetings down there on the river with people who were involved in opposing that. And that was around the same time as the National Environmental Policy Act and the appearance of environmental impact statements, and they had really helped for many years until the last four, really. We had a pretty good thing going. Things seem to be fairly under control, but I hope that we can return to that now.
Yeah. Well, you're asking for a return to reason and sanity, and it seems to be in short supply right now.
Yeah, I'm afraid it is. I just hope things are changing in D.C. That's all you can say.
A couple things, but Biden canceled the Keystone pipeline permit,
yes,
which was a good thing. After people have been, you know, shot with rubber bullets and sprayed and everything else for, you know, protesting it, you know, for this long. And I saw something with Ted Cruz, my favorite Republican, my favorite one to hate anyway, talking about that and how, oh, you know, thousands of jobs are going away. But in reality, we're talking about trying to change the energy system in the United States, where we could get millions of jobs going in the solar industry and that sort of thing. So wind and solar are very important, but they seem to not – I don't think that's where the money comes from those industries. So.
Well, the fuel industry is so – has been around so long, has so much money, they're so deeply ingrained. You know, anything that looks like it doesn't come from that or support that is a radical notion at this point. So they're not going to go down easy, that's for sure. I mean, they're not going to go down without a fight. And, you know, they can buy anybody they want to buy. I mean, it's basically going to be up to me and you to decide, yeah, I'm done with driving a car that takes gas. I'm done with plugging into the grid. You know, until we decide we're going to do that, you know, there'll be no, you know, governmental direction to do that. I don't know how you would make that happen. There's just so much money supporting those fossil fuel industries.
Well, we had a good start, actually, under Obama.
We did.
We had a good start on solar, and wind power is still okay because, you know, they seem to be more popular among the fossil fuel people who are actually investing in wind farms.
Right.
And solar is, of course, the answer. And
sure.
There are people doing it all the time. You'll look around. If you drive around enough in Bloomington, you'll see some houses with solar panels on the roof. Yep. And my former graduate advisor at IU in graduate school, he's in his 80s, and he just recently, this last past year, invested in a complete total solar outfit for his house, which he said would never pay for itself in his lifetime, but over the lifetime of the house, it will more than pay for itself.
Well, we looked at that, Don, 2 years ago when the full rebate was still available from the government. And even at the substantial cost it was going to take for me to put that in, I have REMC Electric, which is quadruple the Duke rate from Indianapolis.
Right.
You know, I have just ridiculous bills, and mine was going to pay for itself in a little over 3 years.
Oh, wow. That's been great.
Yeah. So we're, you know, I'm waiting for, I think there'll be another round of rebates or tax breaks to come out of this administration. When that happens, we probably will pull the trigger to do that.
Well, that'd be a great idea. I wish I could. I got too many trees outside of my house.
Exactly.
To put them on there. But the way my former advisor did it was that some company, this is all tied in with Duke, of course,
mm-hmm.
some company comes and puts all the stuff in for you, you know, does it all up. You own it, you know, you pay for it over time. And then to get into the grid, they are the ones that make the deal with Duke.
Right.
So it's not you and Duke, it's this other corporation entity and Duke. And who knows how that will all work out, but I hopefully they won't figure out to steal all of the profit you're going to make from feeding the grid. Hopefully, but you can bet that they're going to try to weasel out of that.
And, well, no question, and it'll be harder for them to weasel out of it if an entity that has multiple stakeholders, as opposed to you negotiating your own deal with Duke, you know how that would work out.
Yes, right. just like it always works out.
Yeah, exactly. But that, okay. It'll look pretty slick to me.
Yes.
I got a big barn out there. I built the barn facing south so that, you know, we could do that at some point if it ever got viable that solar energy was cheap enough to do. You know, the batteries seem to be the big bite at this point, but that technology is getting better every year. So I don't think it'll be very long, probably in my lifetime and yours, we'll see the, you know, viability of solar energy for individuals. You know, it's already viable in Western states for entire utilities. So I suspect that, you know, we'll see something here in the next two or three years that we'll probably continue to see these people with more solar panels on the roof.
Well, I hope so.
Well, and there's another thing. I work for a company. I have been friends with a guy in a construction business for about, well, since the 70s. And he's a minority businessman. He's from Liberia originally. You met him, Don.
Yes, I did.
Years back. And he's been by here. Anyway, he built some stuff he's now in Texas and New Jersey. And he has putting together with another company that does solar, these farms, which are in places in third world countries, are very important because, for one, they don't have the grid at all. And secondly, you can put together a big solar farm that's sort of a conglomerate for people. And I really hope that that's the way it goes, even more than the personal thing, is once you can band together as a community and everybody sort of shares the costs and you get a bigger chunk of energy being created, then it's going to be a little bit more. I think when the companies like Duke Energy find out that you're able to, that there's so much energy being produced, that they're certainly going to want a cut of that, you know?
Well, that's the reason I'd go for I prefer the individual approach. And right. I have friends up in Upper Peninsula of Michigan who are totally off the grid. Mm-hmm. And, they have a combination of solar, wind, and then wood heat in the winter.
Yep.
Have no problems. I mean, problems do happen, especially with the windmills. But, you know, any place there's a lot of wind, what happens eventually is that windmill goes galloping and gets ripped to pieces by the wind. But if you replace those, you know, every few years, you got a good deal, because when the sun's not out, the wind's usually blowing. Not always, but if you live on Lake Superior, and probably a good bet that you're going to have wind most of the time.
Well, and they're also coming up with new technologies nowadays. You got these wind turbines. There's not as many moving parts. They're more enclosed, and they don't get destroyed that easily unless you have a, you know, tornado or a microburst or something real bad. But there is some improvement everywhere you look, you know.
Yeah, well, solar is magic. Yeah, I've told you guys before, I mentioned on this show that my camper I have rigged with solar, and I got 320 watts of solar panels out there that can run my TV, my satellite TV, all the lights, the water pump, the water heater. I can run everything except heating and cooling, and I could run the microwave if I had the right day and had the batteries charged to as much as possible. I could run the microwave for a little while, but it's just magic, you know. It's free. And I think I've got, with all of the stuff, the ancillary stuff, you know, the inverters and the fuses and the wires and the plugs and all the things that you have to put that system together, I probably got $500 in it.
Yeah. And
for that, I get free electricity, you know, for as long as I want it.
Well, and you can go to the more primitive space, you know, camping too, right? I mean,
without
worries.
Only drawback is the old trick of water.
Yeah.
Water is always the defining or the limiting factor.
Right. Well, you can always deal with that with bringing it along, but of course that's a hassle too, you know.
Yeah. Ain't it the truth? Yeah, I think in the end, the technology for batteries is going to be key. You know, the ability to make them a little bit more efficient, make them last a little bit longer, and make them, you know, less damaging, you know, on the total environment to produce. I think all of those things is being worked on. I think as we
are you there?
We're here.
Yep.
When did you lose me?
Right after you got done.
Yeah, when you were done.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, good.
Yeah.
I guess there's some administrative rule changes on various hunting and fishing laws. You want to go through those?
Sure.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of interesting. This is on the DNR's webpage. I'll give you that address when I get done, if you're interested. The first one, it says muzzle loaders for deer. This is one's kind of humorous. Remove the restriction requiring the powder used in muzzle loaders to be loaded only from the muzzle end of the muzzle loader. This change would allow deer hunters the option to use additional muzzle loaders during the firearms and muzzle loader season, including new equipment that has the powder encased and loaded from the breech end, like a cartridge, thereby keeping the powder dry. Because the powder is protected inside a vessel, the cartridge, it may also increase the number of days an individual can hunt because they are not affected by rainy conditions. The bullet must still be loaded from the muzzle. Well, what it says, they want to put it in from the breech, and then it says at the end, the bullet. Oh, I see. You put the powder cartridge in the breech, and you still put the bullet, the ball, down the front of the gun, like the old muzzle loaders. Now, how about that? Isn't that going around the barn lot there?
Yeah. Pretty soon, it'll just be called rifle season instead of, you know, all that. I mean, I saw that and I was like, wow.
You did see that? Well,
yeah. What a hard way to get around.
I know. It's like Parcheesi, you know.
Yeah.
So we're going to have we're still going to have muzzle loaders, but instead of putting the powder down the muzzle of the gun, we put it in the back of the gun at the breech, and then we put the ball down on top of that from the front. So it's still technically a muzzle loader in some ways.
So here's what I don't get. I don't get who thinks of this. Set of circumstances would cause you to think, hey, I think we could do this a different way? And then, first of all, to think of it. Second of all, to get it in front of the government and have the government actually act on it.
Well, I know exactly how this works. Somebody, some big arms manufacturer, has come up with this muzzle loader that loads from the breech. Of course, they have to produce these cartridges with powder in them to work in their new muzzle loading that's not a muzzle loader weapon. So they have no problem getting access to any legislator in Indiana, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And
it had to be that way, didn't it, of course?
Well, it seems logical that was the way.
Sure.
It's happened that way in other things in the past. Okay, that's number one. Now, the next one is wild turkey hunting equipment. Have you seen this one too, Alan?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I'll go through it for everybody else out there. Allow wild turkey hunters the option of using 28, 16, or 10 gauge and 410 gauge shotguns to hunt wild turkeys, in addition to other equipment that is already legal in the spring and fall turkey seasons. So we're adding these shotguns. The 410 has less recoil than some of the current shotguns that are currently legal, meaning the 12 gauge, making it easier for youth and others to use. The additional change to allow tungsten super shot number 9 and other size shot, number 9 shot, will allow new types of shot that are now available for wild turkey hunting. There's a, here again, we got some manufacturer who has come up with a new shot. The proposed language for the shot density is included for the purpose of restricting shot compositions to those shot sizes and densities that will remain effective at 40 yards or less to assure a quick kill on a wild turkey while reducing the severity of accidental shooting of humans. I don't see how that reduces the severity of that. I guess if you get shot with a 410 using number 9 shot, it's not going to be as bad if you got hit with a 12 gauge loaded with number 4 or slugs. You know, I guess.
You know, at 40 yards or less, if you can't see anybody standing on the other side of the turkeys, you probably shouldn't be hunting.
Well, yeah.
You know,
40 yards. 40 yards isn't very far.
No.
But, you know, especially with a rifle, of course, if you got your muzzle loader with the cartridge and a muzzle loading bullet, you don't have to worry about that. Or if you've got your 30-30. But since they have these seasons separated, I don't know why they do. You know, it really makes little sense. I know there are guys who like to use real muzzle loaders, and there's probably guys that will use these new ones. It'll open up a new market for them. But
sure,
why not just mix them in, your muzzle loading in with the regular firearm season, and extend the firearm season to cover all that? You know,
I don't know.
It's
you. I mean, you probably would have a better handle on that than me. I, you know, it's I've scratched my head for decades of looking at that, going, now why would you do that?
It's the only reason you do it is to sell this new equipment, I think.
Yeah, has to be.
I could be totally wrong, but I suspect that that's the way it is.
Don, when I read that, I didn't see 20 gauge in there. Did you? I thought I read it two or three times, and they didn't have 20 gauge.
No, there is no 20 gauge in there. Unless that's legal already.
Well, how'd they sneak the 10 gauge in there? That's what I wonder. That's certainly not going to be
20 gauge.
Better for the kids.
10 gauge. That's, you know, that's a pretty big gun.
That's a big gun.
That's a duck. That's an old punt gun.
That'll knock you down if you don't watch out.
So they're featuring the 410 along with the 10 gauge. That's quite a range of.
And they've added 16 and 28. That's the skeet gun. You know.
Yeah. Right.
So it's quite a cornucopia of shotgun loving shooters.
Yeah.
Will be served by this. I don't know. You know, if I used to hunt with a 410, I'll tell you what, it doesn't carry very far. You better be right on when you shoot that. Or you're going to wound a lot of birds.
Yep.
410. Okay. Next one up here is a fish. This is rule on fish. And this only applies to four lakes in Noble County, Indiana. Now, it starts off saying that this rule, this new rule change, saying carp can survive in poor water conditions and outcompete bluegill and other popular sport fish, especially when there are few largemouth bass. Okay. Studies show very large carp populations in these four lakes. And I'll tell you those four lakes in just a second. But few bass above the current legal limit that can help control carp. Increasing the minimum size requirement for largemouth bass and reducing the daily bag limit will result in a more and greater number of large bass and that can control carp populations. This will also result in more and larger bluegill. Using largemouth bass to control carp avoids the high costs associated with more extreme and intensive management options like fish eradication and restocking. So they're going to get largemouth bass big enough to swallow that 25-pound carp that you see on this rolling on the surface. I don't know. I don't know. But they're going to try it. That's in Bixler, Henderson, Little Long, and Round Lakes in Noble County up northern Indiana.
Yeah.
So I've always heard that it's good for bluegill, but if you have too many carp in there, I don't see these bass doing much to control very big carp. I mean, you know, my gosh, they get the size of submarines.
Right. And,
Well, and they're all the time trolling on those little flat spots where the bluegill are, yes. I mean, you know.
Yes.
They're right there. They're right among them. I mean, you'd have to literally wipe them out to make a big difference.
I agree. I don't see how that's going to really help, but I don't see any bad thing about limiting the daily bag limit and increasing the minimum size requirement for keeping them. That has to be good no matter what you say, whether they're trying to control carp or increase the bass fishery. I would hope that it would help control the carp so that we could have some good bluegill fisheries.
Yeah. What happened to carp season? You know, when I was a little boy, I'd go carp spear fishing with my granddad. I still got the 24-foot spear.
Yeah.
Barn that, you know, my granddad used to use, and, you know, they would, you know, he would get a boat full of carp, you know, in, you know, an afternoon.
Well, back when I was a young guy, we used to archer, you know, we'd take archers,
yeah,
bow and arrows out, and, you know, you got a reel on your bow and string attached to your arrow. And I used to go out with a local guy and do this down at Lake Monroe and a few places over in Greene County. And man, you can harvest a lot of fish, and it may not that be good to, that great to eat, but they make great fertilizer.
Yeah. Well, that's why I don't understand. You're talking about four lakes. You would think that somebody could bring an open season on carp, extend the season, whatever, incentivize people to get rid of the carp. I would think that would be a far faster way to do this than waiting for the bass populations to get big enough to help control. I mean, that's, you're talking about carp that may live 10, 12 years.
Oh, probably longer.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I didn't know. I'm not up to date on the carp fishing rules, but
yeah.
I never knew there were any rules about carp fishing.
Well, there may not have been.
Well, we go out with the bow and arrow. I never thought about it being a season for that, since it was, you know, seemed like we were doing a public service. But, you know, you got to be the kind of fellow that can enjoy that.
Yeah.
And I got a little tired of it after a while. But anyway, that's the rule. If for four lakes in northern Indiana, we're gonna make bigger bass. Okay. Add a definition of pink salmon and include the definition of trout and salmon. Okay, let's see what this one has to say. Division Fish and Wildlife says the state record for pink salmon, and pink salmon is currently included in the trout and salmon bag limit in the Indiana Fishing Regulations Guide. However, pink salmon is not currently included in the definition of trout and salmon in the Indiana Administrative Code, which creates ambiguity for anglers. Oh my gosh. Adding pink salmon to the administrative code will simplify the rules and provide a greater clarity on if an angler has reached the bag limit when catching this rare fish. Okay. I didn't know that people really sought out pink salmon, but apparently somebody must. And I could see if it's not counted as a bag limit in the current trout and salmon rules, well, you could probably harvest all of them you wanted, huh?
Yeah.
And of course, this leads the conservation officers to probably have some questions about who to arrest and who not to arrest.
Yeah. I've never seen pink salmon that I'm aware of.
This is only, again, for Lake Michigan, so, you know.
Yeah.
But very few of these things apply to us down here.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the next one, is a 14-inch minimum size limit for sauger. Reduce the daily bag limit to 6 sauger, walleye, and sockeye in the aggregate to reduce the possession limit to 12 in total of sauger, walleye, and sockeye for sport fishing on the Ohio River. So I'm not sure what the ramifications of that might be, except that the increasing the minimum size limit to 14 inches for sauger, and there are quite a few sauger in the Ohio River. People do fish for them down there. reducing the bag limit to 6. Well, that seems reasonable for sauger, walleye, and sockeye in aggregate. So if you get any of those fish that look like a walleye but might be a sauger or a sockeye, will be counted in your bag limit. And reduce the possession limit to 12 for sport fishing on the Ohio River. So I don't know what the current limit is. It must be more than 12, huh?
Must be. That's quite a lot.
That's just the introduction to this rule.
Yeah.
they're not providing enough protection to sauger, they say, to keep from being overfished, and it threatens the availability of this popular species for future anglers. Several Midwestern state fish and wildlife agencies have examined sauger trends and recommend increasing size limit and reducing bag limit to help sauger reproduction. Okay, so they've already been passed by other states, probably Ohio and Kentucky, and and the other Ohio River states. So anyway, sauger, that's if you're a sauger fishing. I know there's guys, I don't know whether either one of you remember Norm Merrifield, who used to be in the Parks and Recs department here, ran the West Side Center for a while, but his dad lived in Indianapolis and was a sauger fisherman, and he used to fish for sauger up there in the White River all the time. And I didn't even know there were sauger fishermen in Indiana, but I guess there's some fish there.
Wow.
So then there's another one. They're going to add a minimum size limit for sauger at Glen Flint Lake in Putnam County. That's the only one that's close to us, I think, in any of these rules here. Glen Flint Lake is a newly approved effort will improve fishing opportunities in this county. The other two sauger fisheries in Indiana use a 14-inch minimum size limit to provide opportunities to catch larger sauger, which are preferred by anglers.
Is that a pay-per-fish lake?
I don't know. I've heard of it before. I've never been there.
Me neither.
I don't know where it is. I know one of them was Sullivan Lake over by Sullivan, Indiana. They were stocking sauger in there, and they were also stocking sauger at Huntingburg Lake, the city reservoir there.
Right.
So that's the only ones that I know of that might be sauger lakes. A friend of mine and I spent a whole summer one year trying to catch a sauger, and we went to several lakes that they had stocked at the time with sauger, and we never saw a sauger.
Yeah.
We fished for hours and hours for them. Okay. Well, so much for that. There's another mussel that they want to change. They're adding the golden mussel to the list of exotic mussels that cannot be imported, possessed, or released into public or private waters in Indiana.
Oh, boy.
So some are the most endangered animals in the state. They act as natural filters for waterways, serve as important source of food for many animals, and increase oxygen exchange for aquatic animals. Golden mussels are an exotic mussel that may negatively impact the already threatened mussels if introduced. So this is like the zebra mussel, I assume. And if you ever been to Lake Erie before and after zebra mussels, you can see what happened up there. It turned the water crystal clear and reduced the fish population.
Yeah.
Probably not good to have these exotic, invasive mussels adding to the load on our good old Indiana mussels. Okay, they're adding definitions for drop lines, limb lines, float line, free float lines, trot lines, set lines, and throw lines. Okay, drop line, limb line, free float line, trot line, set line, and throw line are all terms used in the Indiana fishing regulations. Adding definitions to these terms to the administrative code will reduce ambiguity for anglers and allow anglers and conservation officers to have a shared, clear understanding of different fishing methods. So they have a different rule for each one of those, I guess. It's hard to say, let alone conceive of a different rule for all those different kinds of lines that you can use.
I was going to say, and I'll bet they don't have a photograph of them explaining or showing what they are either, do they?
No, they do not. they do not. Okay, the next one is one that should have happened a long time ago. Add ruffed grouse to endangered species of birds in Indiana. Historically, ruffed grouse existed throughout all of Indiana. Now populations have declined, are less than 1% of the levels observed in the 1980s. Ruffed grouse are on track for a local extinction. I think they are, without major management actions. Have you seen any grouse where you live now?
Not a one.
I would say, you know, there used to be grouse all over down there.
Oh, sure.
Adding ruffed grouse to the state endangered species list will require environmental reviews in forested environments to consider the impact. So we're going to have an environmental impact statement to put these guys on the endangered species list.
Oh, boy.
So grouse populations are expected to benefit from active forest management, including intense and frequent actions to change the plant community and structure. Now, that is clear cutting they're talking about there.
I was going to say, that's a euphemism for clear cutting.
Yeah, they had to use a whole lot of words to avoid saying clear cutting.
Yep.
Allowing ruffed grouse to become totally extirpated from Indiana would indicate a failure to act as stewards for this species and require expensive restoration efforts that are unlikely to succeed without the pressing habitat management actions that are already required. Wow. Okay, well, anyway, if you see a ruffed grouse, don't kill it.
Yeah.
I haven't seen one in a number of years now.
It's been so long since I've seen a grouse, Don, I'm not sure I'd recognize it if I saw it.
Well, I haven't seen any. Haven't seen any in Indiana, but
yeah,
I still know what they look like and how they sound and, you know, all that. But I haven't seen one here in 30 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So we got a snake regulation. Subspecies names for the following species of snakes: ringneck snake, common garter snake, eastern ribbon snake, northern water snake, smooth earth snake. You've ever seen one of those? Those are pretty cool.
They are.
Racer, eastern worm snake, that's pretty cool too. Also modify the taxonomic nomenclature of these four snakes held under a reptile captive breeding license. Western fox snake, I've never seen one of those. Eastern black king snake, eastern milk snake, and prairie king snake. Allow a method of marking snakes under the captive breeding license other than pit tagging or scale clipping. They want to allow scale clipping.
Hey, I'm hearing the music. We're almost out of time. Well, sorry to say.
I'm sorry I got involved in this, Frank.
I'm glad we heard those.
No, it's fascinating. I'd like to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about snakes next time. So
there's a chorus frog that disappeared actually from Indiana, which is not good. So there are more of these. We can talk about these all day next time.
Yeah.
Okay.
You lucky devils.
We'll keep out of the cold this next week. It looks like it's going to be kind of warmer by next weekend, so hopefully it'll be a little better next week. But as for today, we want to say sign off and thanks for listening and glad to see you. Good to see you guys, too.
Good to see you guys. Stay safe.
All of you. Oh, I got my virus shot. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, hopefully I'll get mine here one of these days.
Hopefully all of us.
I haven't grown up enough to get one yet.
Oh, yeah, my wife either.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Inside Outdoors comes to you from the beautiful rolling hills and green forests of southern Indiana. Thanks for listening. Inside Outdoors is brought to you each week on Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. If you happen to miss the show, you can listen online at wfhb.org. Just go to the public affairs listing and you'll find a podcast of our show.